All right, everybody. Circle the wagons. Oh, we got a little visitor tonight. Oh, so cute. New fan. Hi, everyone. Is everybody doing okay? Yeah. It is, I know. Hopefully we all stay awake. If I sound or seem sick, it's because I am. So stay away from me. I'll just stay up here and you can stay out there. But say a quick prayer for me. Today I've just not felt great. Maybe it's because we're talking about politics tonight. I don't know. But yeah, exactly. Maybe you'll all feel as sick as I do by the time we're done. No, not at all. Will somebody pray for us tonight? Just get us started.
I will.
Amen. Well, like I already said, we are talking about God and government. We're talking about politics. And as I've reflected on that, I just don't think there's anything quite as polarizing as politics in our culture today. That is such an incredibly polarizing issue. I think maybe it used to be religion, but I think at least with religion, people respect your opinion even if they don't want to talk to you about it. But with politics, it's like fights break out when you just bring it up. At least that's been my experience. So I don't bring it up much, especially with our current. The election just happening, our current economic climate. I mean, I just feel like it's actually just gotten harder and harder to have a civil conversation with anybody about politics, and harder for politicians to have civil conversations with each other. And I think the proof is in the pudding for me here is between these two questions, which makes you more uncomfortable thinking about answering, right, with someone you don't know? Which of these two questions? So what church do you go to? Or who did you vote for in 2012, right? Which would you be more nervous answering to a stranger, someone you don't know? So it's probably the political question. It's like that question has become so personal. Who you vote for is usually an indictment against your very character and your very soul. It's true. It really is. I mean, families can't even talk about this. Maybe that's not saying much, but families can't even talk about this. And it's just such a strange time we find ourselves in. And I think the situation is particularly delicate for evangelical Christians. I am so hesitant in conversations with people to label myself an evangelical Christian, not because of the theological assertions that usually go along with that, but because of the political baggage that goes along with that. And I know Gabe can probably affirm that in Kansas City, that call yourself an evangelical Christian carries a lot of baggage that we don't necessarily mean to communicate. So it's hard to say these things. And as you think about that, what are some assumptions, common assumptions that people make about evangelical Christians and politics? Just common assumptions. You're conservative. You're a lunatic. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're crazy. I've heard that. Intolerant. Yeah, particularly with gay rights, or women's rights with the abortion question. Don't care about the poor. Yep, heard that one. All right, there are probably more. You're pro-military. You're pro-war. Maybe is a negative way of putting that. You're against high taxes and programs for the poor, and I mean all this baggage. What? You're guns rights. Yeah, I mean it's like when you say that phrase, there's like a whole ticket that goes along with it. Whether we mean to or not, that's just kind of what's happened. So I think in all of our, I hope even in your own life, you feel this is a relevant topic, right? How are Christians supposed to engage with their government, especially kind of in the climate we find ourselves in today? And there are two we're gonna talk about tonight, and you'll see them in your notes. We're gonna talk first about like the two historical extremes that Christian traditions have leaned toward and how they interact with politics. So the first is politicized and the second is privatized. We're going to talk about those. And then we're going to go to Scripture and see what are some principles that Jesus and Paul in particular teach us that we can begin crafting a way between these two extremes in how we interact with our government and politics today. The last bullet is on the example of William Wilberforce. We're probably not going to have time to get there, but you're reading a whole book on him, so I know you'll have plenty of time to discuss that together. All right, so let's jump in. Politicized faith. This extreme, this historical extreme, is as old as Constantine. So Constantine was a Roman emperor who converted to Christianity. Depending on which historian you ask, he had some kind of religious experience and legalized and mandated Christianity in the Roman Empire. And that was the first time that the state and the faith kind of married together. And this kind of is that's the first example of the church attempting to bring God's kingdom through a political force of will. This is the first time that God's kingdom and God's king or God's emperor became one. And other extreme examples of this interaction of faith and politics are like the Crusades, right? So we're on God's mission, God's political mission to conquer these lands. It's a politicized faith. Those are extreme examples. In our modern context, we see this extreme when evangelicals become a political force or a body of voters, right? Maybe you've heard that before. We're often kind of thrown together and thought of as a political vote that politicians need to vie for and get. And that's a politicized faith. And I want to show you a news clip. This is from back in 2007. So this is before the 2008 election. But I think it's still really helpful just in seeing how the media views this interaction of faith and politics. And two Christian scholars kind of debate, or, represent two sides of this political issue. And so I just want to take a look at it. This is CBS from 2007.
It's a new kind of political holy war for the hearts and minds of the roughly 50 million evangelical Christians in this country. Do you believe that evangelical Christians are still the domain of the GOP?
No. I think things are changing dramatically. They're up for play.
Evangelicals became a potent political force during the Reagan Revolution.
I want you to know that I endorse you.
Politics supplied the perfect bully pulpit for their conservative viewpoints, emphasizing two issues above all: opposition to gay rights and abortion rights. For more than two decades, their support at the polls has been critical to Republican victories. But that may be changing, and many younger evangelicals are behind it.
But a whole generation says, no, there are more than two moral values issues. There's Darfur. There's global poverty. There's climate change. There's human trafficking.
And in this new agenda, the old issues aren't as prominent. A new CBS News poll out tonight shows that abortion and gay rights aren't even among the top four priorities evangelicals want presidential candidates to discuss. In fact, healthcare and Iraq dominate, which creates a chasm between progressive evangelicals like Jim Wallace and more traditional leaders like Richard Land.
Why were the followers of the Prince of Peace the easiest ones to convince to go to war in Iraq?
I believe that when people are at war with you, it's best to be at war with them.
We are doing spiritual warfare and battle here.
Land also thinks the two issues that united evangelicals shouldn't divide them now.
The protection of the sanctity of human life from conception to natural death and everywhere in between. Secondly, protection of traditional marriage.
But our poll shows that poverty trumps abortion as an issue evangelicals care about. In fact, Jim Wallace believes the term pro-life should be redefined.
If I'm an unborn child and I want the support of the far religious right, I better stay unborn as long as possible. Because once I'm born, I'm off the radar screen. No health care, no child care, no nothing.
Different priorities may mean a new acceptance of a new kind of GOP candidate. Current frontrunner Rudy Giuliani, who would be the first Republican nominee in three decades to support abortion rights, is almost tied for first among white evangelical voters. If Giuliani succeeds, Land says the party might be over, and a third candidate, a real social conservative, could emerge.
It'd be like asking an abolitionist to vote for a pro-slavery candidate. You just can't do it.
Support for abortion rights isn't this year's only GOP heresy. Candidates like Giuliani, John McCain, and Fred Thompson have trouble even talking about their faith and their church attendance.
Don't attend regularly.
The most important thing is that I am a Christian. I don't have anything else to say about the issue.
I'm not running for religious office.
Meanwhile, social conservatives may not attend this election if their enthusiasm for the candidates doesn't improve. 40% of them say they are less excited about going to the polls this time.
Lord,
once a Republican mainstay, values voters could become the new swing voters. And at this point, it's anyone's guess who will convert them.
God is not a Republican or a Democrat. And people of faith shouldn't be in any party's political pocket.
The Values Voters Summit goes through Sunday. So far, every major GOP candidate has agreed to appear.
Thank you, Katie Couric. Regardless of, you know, the specifics of what people were saying, isn't that just an interesting case study on the interaction between the Christian faith in America and politics? What, at the end?
Did she say that
pro-life
is a heresy?
Pro-life
heresy. Yeah, she called it
the
pro-life heresy.
Come on, Katie Couric.
There's a reason why they fired her.
That's why she went to CBS. Couldn't stay at NBC, you know? I don't know. But just thinking about analyzing evangelicals as, oh, they used to be a solid GOP vote, now they're a swing vote, and how are we going to get them? And just talking about Christianity as a political body. And it's interesting how the media we're just so often framed as who's going to win this vote. And James Hunter, he wrote a book called To Change the World, which it's about how cultural change happens and how Christians can be a part of that. It's a great book. It's actually kind of a hard read, but it's a good book. He has this great quote in there about this issue of a politicized faith, and he says this: "It is not an exaggeration to say that the dominant public witness of the Christian churches in America since the early 1980s has been a political witness. It is not an exaggeration to say that the dominant public witness of the church in America has been a political witness since the 1980s. And the church is becoming synonymous with a voting bloc. I think it's hard to argue with that. And this is an example of the politicization of the faith. This is the church, in a lot of ways, the church succumbing to the conviction that politics is the best way to enact change in our culture and to be a witness to our culture, that politics is the vehicle to do that. And this is part of a broader cultural push, I think, that is occurring in our country. And this is just my opinion, but there's a tendency now for group identity, for groups to find legitimacy in creating a power base and a political identity. And you see that in when faith becomes politicized, I guess is what I'm saying. In other words, Christians begin to see themselves as another special interest group, vying for a politician and a platform and a party that will secure their agenda and their needs. Faith becomes an ideology quickly when we go down this path. I think there are two tragedies that result from that situation. I think the first is that the church becomes better known for her politics than for her good news. And whether we meant to do it or not, I think in a lot of ways we've done that. The church has become better known for her politics and for her gospel. That's the first tragedy. And the second is that Christians have lost a lot of ground in cultural engagement because we have focused solely on politics. which is simply a way that culture changes. And it's perhaps not even the primary way that it changes, which is really the whole argument of this book, is that politics is really the kind of the last stage in cultural change. and you see that, don't you? You see that these things are happening in the culture, and then they make their way into politics, and by the time it gets to the political stage, the conversation's over. It's like, we're doing this now. And we've missed out on the beginning of the conversation as Christians. And I think we're getting better at that. But a politicized faith, it focuses on the wrong area. And I love what Chuck Colson said in response. This was an op-ed piece. This op-ed piece was written in the New York Times a few years ago after Obama was first elected. So this is 2008. And the author of the piece, his name was Frank Rich. The article is basically that evangelicals had suffered a major defeat when McCain lost the election. That this was a huge blow to evangelical Christianity, right? And Colson responded in his own article, and he said, "So the most important thing right now is for serious evangelicals of all political interests and all shades of theology, left and right, to join together to proclaim the good news, protect the family, build the church, help the suffering, and defend the truth, all the while avoiding, as I've written for years, becoming a special interest group or placing ourselves in the hip pocket of any political party." And here's how he concludes. Again, the author that he's responding to is named Frank Rich. "No matter who wins or loses the election, I'm sorry, Mr. Rich, the kingdom of God will grow even stronger and be standing tall on inauguration morning as ever. The kingdom of God will not come on Air Force One, no matter who the president is." And that's because it's a great summary response to this tendency toward a politicization of our faith. That politics, as important as they are, and engagement there is important, will not bring God's kingdom. And we cannot place our messianic hope on who is elected. Cannot do it. Our Messiah came and died, and he reigns, regardless of who is president. Okay, questions about that? All right. Well, let's move to the next extreme, privatized faith. Is this the other historical Christian extreme in how to interact with politics, privatized faith. And a really good definition of a privatized faith, it comes from something called an Evangelical Manifesto. It's this document. It's available online as a PDF at unevangelicalmanifesto.com. It's written by prominent evangelical scholars. People like Oz Guinness helped write this, and Dallas Willard. So those are two people we study in Razors. And here's how they define this kind of privatized faith. One error has been to privatize faith, interpreting and applying it to the personal and spiritual realm only. Such dualism falsely divorces the spiritual from the secular and causes faith to lose its integrity and become privately engaging and publicly irrelevant, which basically means that in a privatized faith, it's just like it sounds. It means you do not let your faith influence your politics at all. And personally, I feel that in my generation and younger Christians, this is the extreme that generation is swinging to. I think we're coming out of a more politicized extreme, and we're swinging to a privatized extreme, which a withdrawal from the political sphere completely. And there are really two types of a privatized faith, I think. There are two kinds, two strains. The first says that faith is irrelevant to politics. So the first type of a privatized faith says that faith is irrelevant to politics. And a mantra there might be, faith is something that does not affect every area of my life, and my politics are not affected by my religious convictions. These are just two separate realms altogether. And maybe a famous example of this, at least in one article, is an interview with Jimmy Carter. I'm not saying that he always felt this way, but he didn't phrase this well. And he was one of the first kind of evangelical born-again presidential candidates, right, that really kind of ran on that ticket. And after he was president, he was interviewed in Time magazine, and here's what he said to the interviewer. He said, "Well, I've never found any real conflict between my religious faith and my political posture, but I do think the realm of religion and the realm of politics should be completely separated. A president ought not to take any action that would promote a certain religion over others, And that, unfortunately, has been violated in recent years. Now, with the second part of that quote, I agree, right? I think we would all agree that we can't use religion to oppress other people, which is what he's saying. But the first part of this, I don't think the realm of religion and the realm of politics, I think they should be completely separated, is what he said. I think the realm of politics and the realm of religion should be completely separated. First of all, I don't think that's good. And second of all, I don't think it's possible. Politics is inherently value-based, isn't it? I mean, politics is about what we value, what's important. And that is a religious question. It always has been, it always will be. What we value, what is important, what is good and what is bad, those are religious questions. Politics and faith, values and religion, that's a part of the political discussion. It has to be. It's going to be. And to actually say that religion should not be a part of politics is itself a value statement about politics. It's impossible to not bring that into the equation. That's a part of who we are as human beings. So in summary, there's this strain that there's this divide between what I privately believe and what I publicly do in my politics. That's one version of a privatized faith. I think the more common one in younger Christians is the second, and that is that faith is incompatible with politics. That faith is incompatible with politics. And that this, you know, kind of a summary there is all political systems are so corrupt that we must completely disengage from speaking into them and create our own counterculture, right, in the church or in the commune or whatever that is, in the monastery. And the number of Christians in the current generation, like I said, I think have adopted more this kind of cynicism toward engagement in politics and just totally withdrawing. And there's been a resurgence of a strain of Christian theology called Anabaptist theology, which is where we get traditions like Quakerism and Mennonite, which are, you know, you look at those traditions and those are not only politically disengaged, but culturally disengaged. I mean, they don't interact with the culture at all. Because, and again, it's for similar reasons. They say it's incompatible. My faith is incompatible with where my culture is going completely. I have to withdraw. And I think a famous example of this way of thinking in popular Christian writing, maybe you've heard of him, his name is Shane Claiborne. He's written several books. One's called Jesus for President. He's what's called a new monastic. There's this new group of guys called the new monastics. And if you think monastic, you think monastery, you think monk, right? I mean, that's the strain. They've set up communes, and they are completely their own subculture of Christians. Claiborne is a very influential writer and thinker. He's a brilliant guy, and he really discourages political engagement as Christians, mostly because he feels the two are incompatible. Interesting, yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it really does. That's interesting information. And it really feels like the pendulum just keeps swinging back and forth. Because I definitely feel in my generation that it's going back to that. That, oh, you know, look at the conservative. It's just totally failed to do anything. And now they're just caught up in it. And we need to just disengage from politics completely. But then again, there's a lot of cynicism about politics right now in general. So that's a whole other discussion. But I want to move into what Jesus says, one of the primary teachings of Jesus on politics. He doesn't talk a lot about it, but this text is one where he does go there. And it's Matthew 22, starting in verse 15. And as you're churning there, I want to give a little context for what's happening. In Matthew's gospel at this point, Jesus has made it to Jerusalem. He is preparing to be executed. He knows he's going to be crucified. And he's in Jerusalem, and he's managed to anger every power base there. he is very controversial. figure. Yes, he's angered every power base there. Everyone is working hard to get rid of him. And in this section of Matthew 22, the Pharisees, the Herodians, the Sadducees, right, these are all very powerful religious and political groups, frankly. And they are asking Jesus these questions to try to trap him. It's the context. To get political leverage over him. That's why they're asking these questions publicly of him. And Matthew 22 is all about how Jesus responds to these questions. And scholars theorize in this section that when you look at Matthew 22, Jesus gets asked first about politics, which we're going to talk about resurrection, and about what is the greatest commandment. Those are the questions he's asked. And scholars theorize that these were hot-button issues in the Jewish circles at the time, and that these scholars are trying to trap him, because politics never change. they're trying to make him answer a question that will tick off half the people that like him, which is, if you've ever watched a political debate, that's mostly what it is. The winner is the guy who ticks off the fewest people. And so they're trying to trap him. They're trying to put him in a corner. Let's read Matthew 22, starting in verse 15. So the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, which is interesting. They hated Jesus so much that they're actually working with the Herodians. The Pharisees hate the Herodians as well, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances." There's the irony. "Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they bring him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and whose inscription is this?" And they said, "Caesar's." And he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's." And when they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. And I just love Jesus here. He's so brilliant. Turns the question on them and stumps them. And if you look at the end of chapter 22, after all of these questions, it ends verse 46, "And no one was able to answer him a word. Nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions." Jesus, brilliant, brilliant response. But let's focus on this one about government. Why are taxes a hot button issue at this time? Well they seem to always be, frankly. It's a big deal today even to talk about, tax policy, and it was a bigger deal then. And scholars estimate that 50 to 60% of money, of Jewish money, went to Rome in taxes. 50 to 60%. So if you think your taxes are bad now, just think about that. And if that were bad enough, the money that they gave went to an occupier. This isn't a government that they chose, the Jews chose, that they elected, that they had any say in. This was a Roman occupier, someone who forced their politics onto them and now are forcing them to pay for those politics to keep going. So it's no wonder that this was a hot button issue. And they also knew theologically this money went to support a military that was evil. It went to support and corrupt. Went to support a political force that was corrupt. It went to support pagan worship of Caesar. Their money was going and doing that. So this is obvious. This is a big issue. And just so you know, for a little bit of background, that kind of the two approaches to government that we've or to politics that we've talked about are represented in the Pharisees and the Herodians. Okay, the Pharisees represent a more privatized faith. The Pharisees didn't accept the Roman occupation, right? They didn't think it was right, and they expressed that opposition by separating themselves through ritual purity and praying for the arrival of the Messiah who would overthrow Rome. Okay, that's kind of like Pharisaicalism 101. All these purity laws were to maintain Torah and to be separate from those unclean heathen, okay? Totally disengaged. And then, on the other side of that fence, there are the Herodians, who are more of the politicized faith. And the Herodians, who worked with the Herodian king in Palestine, who was a puppet king that Rome set up just to kind of placate people, They really just capitulated to Rome. Herodians didn't believe a Messiah was coming. And so they thought that, you know, let's make life easier on ourselves. Let's go where the power is. And so they would help the Romans and the reigning government there to kind of further their own interests. So right here we've got the privatized faith people and the politicized faith people looking at Jesus and saying, okay, how do you answer this question? Do we pay our taxes or not? And if Jesus answers that it's right to pay taxes, then they know he will fall into disfavor with the poor people that he's very popular with. And they know that if he says, no, you can't, you shouldn't pay your taxes to Caesar, then they can use that as leverage with the Romans to say, this is an insurrectionist. Look what he's saying about the Roman Empire, right? So they think they've got him trapped. This is what they want to do. So here are three observations about how Jesus responds and what that says about Christians and faith and politics. The first thing Jesus does is he puts the discussion, this whole question, in perspective. And he does that in his question when he looks at the coin. He says, whose image is on this coin? Whose image? Now, why is the word image important in the Bible? Why is the word image important in the Bible? Where else do you see the word image? Idolatry, yes, that's true. Image of God, right? It's the first place we see it. Image of God. And what's made in the image of God? Humanity, right? So Jesus is saying, Caesar can have the coin. Caesar can have the coin because God made everything. Everything is God's. God is the ultimate authority. Caesar can put his face on this coin. God has everything, okay? Puts the discussion of politics in perspective. Who reigns? Who is in control? God is in control. Right? He has people. Creation is his. Politics isn't everything. It's the first thing Jesus says. And the second observation, Jesus does clearly demonstrate that he has not come to overthrow the political system by saying, yes, pay your taxes to Caesar. He says, I'm not here to overthrow Rome. I'm here to overthrow a worse oppressor. Satan, sin, and death. That is my mission as Messiah. Something far worse than Caesar. Something far worse than Rome. And then finally, when he says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, in this statement, Jesus legitimizes temporal government authority. He does. And Paul will unpack that. Paul will, out of that strain, will agree. Not only is he not interested in overthrowing the government, he's actually calling people to support that government, at least in paying their taxes. Jesus doesn't contend that the coins do in fact belong to Caesar. He recognizes that Caesar has a sphere of sovereignty over this tax system. And that language of sphere and sovereignty, we're going to come back to that. But with that in mind, let's jump quickly to Paul. In Romans 13, 1-7, Paul is addressing the Christians in the same tax system that Jesus was addressing. And here's what he says to the Roman Christians. Starting in verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, and honor to whom honor is owed. And just a few observations about what Paul is saying to these Christians here. The first is that every human government, the source of their authority is in God. Now, that's not to say that God approves of every government and what they do, But God, government, organization is God's idea, and all authority comes from him. He is the ultimate authority. And there's some, and I understand there's some mystery even in our own lives about how, why bad things happen. Why are there bad governments is the same question as why do bad things happen? Why does God allow that to happen? There's mystery there. But the point here is that all authority comes from God. He is ultimately in control. And he uses government as a minister, is the language that Paul uses, right? As a minister or a servant. And this is liturgical language. That word minister is used of worship services in the temple. So he's saying that government has a spiritual purpose in the world for good by God's design. And then finally, because of all those things, with wisdom, human government is due our support. Taxes were excruciating for the Jews and for these Christians, but Paul says you should pay them. And we owe these people honor, right? We owe honor to people God has put in authority over us. And Peter will agree with those things. I don't have time to read it there, but there's this idea of sphere sovereignty that God has given legitimate authority to human governments and human institutions in general. Now, again, ultimately God is in control of everything, but obviously, and wisdom is required here, and we can't get into every circumstance, but there are times when the government will usurp its authority, right, and cross into the sphere of God's authority. And that's where Christians have had to ask really hard questions and make really hard decisions. And a biblical example of that is Daniel. So the book of Daniel is all about political engagement in a pagan country. Daniel worked for the government. Daniel was a government worker. Not even in Israel, but in a pagan country, right? You've read that book, hopefully. And Daniel legitimately thinks that God can use him in his position for good. That there's something good the government's doing that he can be a part of by God's design. That's how Daniel understands his calling. However, if you know the story, the tension of his story comes when the government says, oh, and by the way, you need to worship this image. And now they're crossing into God's sphere of authority, okay? We only worship God. Only God defines what we worship. Government does not do that. We're not given authority by God to do that. And that's where Daniel says, I'm not going to do it. That's where he draws the line. And that's an act of civil disobedience that Daniel engages in. Civil disobedience. So there's a place for that. I'm not saying that there's a place for that. But I think the default is to submit to our authorities.
Andrew, yeah. Based upon that, then our country, our very country, would be judged by God from the inception, because what the British were doing was not of a moral, one might not say. They were not trouncing on God's territory, but rather on the financial territory. Again, very similar to paying the taxes, outrageous.
I could
be clear. So that would be, for instance, Daniel was a single person saying, I will not be moved. I will not bow down. Okay. But if Daniel decided to lead an insurrection and to revolt and to take over, then you've got more of what we've got in the story of America. So I'm just trying to be clear.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think that's a huge discussion. And historians have had that discussion about kind of the theological foundations of the American Revolution and how the Bible was used or misused in that. That's a huge question. And this is incredibly complex, honestly. I wish I could talk more about this very issue of what does it look like to submit and when is civil disobedience allowed? Christians have disagreed on that for a long time. What I'm trying to say is just give us some broad categories for how to think through this together. And I want to end with this last on common grace in the civil public square. And this is a principle I think we can all take away from here and hopefully begin engaging. Our country is unique in that we can really speak into our political process. Okay, not every Christian has that right or that privilege across the world. And we can engage in conversation about politics in our country. And an emphasis on two things, I think, has to be at the forefront for Christians: common grace and creating a civil public square. And common grace, right, is this idea of unmerited favor and goodness extended to all persons who are made in the image of God, regardless of their eternal destiny. That's common grace. So whether they whatever they believe about Jesus, they are valuable because they are made in God's image. That's the idea of common grace. And that is a uniquely Christian idea. Not every religion, not every ideology believes that about people. Okay, if you disagree with me, I kill you. That's a lot how a lot of the world works, okay? Christianity says no, that every human being is valuable. And that creates a place where dialogue can happen. Because this person is valuable, whether I agree with them or not. Okay, common grace has to be at the center of Christian politics. Has to be. And that will lead, hopefully, to a civil public square where we don't push faith out of the conversation, but we allow many faiths into the conversation. And I think Christians, we've struggled to do those both of those things well at times, and our culture has struggled to do both of those things well at times. So common grace in a civil public square, because we need to set a tone where conversation can happen. It's not happening right now. Both sides demonize the other. There is no common grace characterizing these a lot of political conversations. And Christians need to be at the forefront of helping, nurturing that kind of climate where civil conversation can happen in the public square. We can't be another shouting voice. Okay? It does a disservice to our Lord. We're not another shouting voice. We value every human person, every human opinion. All right. We're done. Sorry I couldn't get to all your questions and Mary's good question. There's huge questions here. Hopefully you can talk in your groups a little bit about it. Have a great week, you guys.